Hello and welcome to the podcast of Westchester University's Office of Research and Sponsored Programs. This is our faculty forum. My name is Lydia Milrod. I am a research graduate assistant in the Office of Research and Sponsored Programs at Westchester University, and I would like to introduce the faculty that we've invited today. Today's topic will be student engagement. Student engagement is a multifaceted definition that is a combination of behavioral, emotional, and cognitive engagement. We will be taking a look at how student engagement relates to research and creative activity. Today, I welcome Dr. Stevie Grossetti, Dr. David Barry, and Dr. Lisa Huebner. Please take a moment to introduce yourselves. We can start with Stevie.
All right. Well, hi, everybody. Stevie Grossetti here. I'm from the psychology department. I started here in Westchester in 2018. I'm an associate professor, and my research focuses on psychological interventions in community settings. So our general questions are, how can we make these interventions more accessible? How can we optimize them and make them better so that they're more potent and helpful for the people who need them?
All right. Awesome.
I'm Dr. Dave Barry. I'm an assistant professor of early grades prep in the Department of Early and Middle Grades Education here at Westchester. This is my fourth year, so going up for tenure next year. Everybody cross your fingers for me. My research is on a few things I'm working on right now. So I have a book coming out next month with Teachers College Press called Addressing Stress with Self-Compassion. It's a guide for early childhood teachers. It's based on my dissertation. And what I found was, if we front load self-compassion skills within pre-service teacher education, they enter their classrooms their first year more equipped to deal with the challenges and stressors of teaching that are leading many to burnout. So that's something that's really important to me, overall teacher well-being. And I'm also working on a project with students right now and two other faculty, Katie Manwiller from the library and Darius McInnes from literacy education. We've been working on a PRG grant and an FPDC grant, and we just got the ODEI grant.
Congrats.
Thanks.
Congratulations.
And we're paying students to work with us to evaluate the quality of diverse representation in children's literature. So looking at not just that there are characters that are of a different race or whose parents are of a different sexual orientation, but that that representation is accurate and loving and will be a good mirror book for kids who don't often find themselves reflected in literature.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful work, and I'm glad to hear about all those successes.
Thanks.
Lisa, go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right. Well, hey, everyone. I'm Dr. Lisa Huebner, and I'm a professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies. I've been here since 2007, and I have one of the reasons I love working here is the opportunity to work with students, you know, so we're not just teaching. We are bringing our students into programming and research. And for me, I've worked with students for my two book projects. My first one was also my dissertation. But when I landed here, I was able to pay some students from a grant to do some last data analysis. And then my second book project was done with a team of students here that we can talk about later. But then my third project that I was just recently awarded a Mellon Foundation grant for is this Women's and Gender Studies collection, which is going to be an open educational resource for anyone in the Commonwealth and beyond. It allows students and faculty to publish and make their work accessible freely and to a wide audience. And we're launching this month. So
that's huge.
Yeah, thank you. That's also been a huge collaboration between students and a bunch of offices on campus. I could never have done any of that without all the collaboration. So yeah, so it's really, I'm really happy to be here and to meet all of you.
That's wonderful. It's great to hear about how community can play such a role in research. Yeah, so that's amazing to hear. So I would like to discuss with you your thoughts on the benefits of student engagement in research and creative activity. Just looking at some prior research, some of those findings include improved feelings of belonging, improved confidence, along with an array of academic benefits such as grades, retention, seeking to go to grad school or get your PhD, and then some things that we already actually just touched on, such as giving back to the public, giving back to the community, feeling connected with people at different levels in their career, feeling connected with faculty. So what are your thoughts on these benefits and how have you seen them play out?
Should we go in the same order? Stevie, you want to go ahead?
Sure.
Well, let me just say, I'll echo a lot of what you've said. So I remember when I was an undergrad, before getting involved in research, I really had no concept of what that meant. So I had this wonderful undergrad research mentor who saw my application to the Honors College and said, hey, do you want to join my research team? And I remember thinking, yeah, that sounds really exciting, but what does it mean? Like, do I wear a lab coat? Like, what do I do? So the answer was no. In our psychological research, I did not wear a lab coat, but I just had no concept. And I think that maybe some students also are at that same point where, like, they want to get more involved in academic pursuits like research, but are not really sure what that means. And that could look very different in different disciplines. But there are so many benefits. And so if you can get over that fear or just like tolerate the uncertainty, I think so many benefits like the ones you talked about. One of my favorite things is seeing students quickly develop from maybe having a low level of research skills to gaining more skills. And in addition to the skills, just gaining more comfort and more confidence and a sense of feeling like they belong not only in the lab, but at the university and the broader academic community. I love seeing that. So it's hard to say concretely, you know, I can definitely see specific skills develop, like the students develop lit review skills if they work with me. But I also see them develop relationships with the graduate students who may work with me. With me, I can always write a stronger letter of recommendation for a student if I've had them in the lab versus just having them in a class. So there's so many different benefits.
Absolutely. And I mean, I personally relate to that as well. In my undergrad, I also wasn't quite sure what that would look like. And when I had an opportunity to engage in research, I also was like, oh, I'm going to be in a lab now. Am I going to wear a lab coat? What's going to happen? And it was all very daunting, honestly. It was daunting. But I'm so glad that I engaged with that because now going into grad school, I realize that I do have those skills. That gives me a little bit of a competitive edge and also is a way that I can support my peers as, you know, we're all learning about these things like data analysis and statistics and psychological research. So I definitely resonate with that. Dave, any thoughts on benefits?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all have similar origin stories, but I think we need to buy our graduate assistants lab coats. I feel like if we all think that that's part of it, like it would be fun that first day to just come dressed in a lab coat. Why not? Even though education research is not really the place for a lab coat. Anyway, when I was in my undergrad, I also had an opportunity to do some research with one of the early childhood faculty. We had a program called SURE. It was the Stonehill Undergraduate Research Experience. And it's kind of close to the SURE acronym, which we have here. And when I found out that was a thing, I talked about it in my job interview. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this is so cool that you all do this. But it was a paid opportunity to work with this professor. And something that I'm learning from our students, and I guess for me in that same situation too, that if you can't see yourself in a role, you don't know, you don't feel that you can necessarily become that. So like you have to see it to be it, right? And I thought I was going to be a kindergarten teacher for the rest of my life when I went to college. And that's what I did for 10 years. But this opportunity to work with this professor and think about this other side of teaching and education and the importance of doing good research so that we can implement that work in classrooms really crystallized for me. So she really inspired me to think about how I would continue on with research and got my master's and while I was teaching and then decided after 10 years of teaching, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go for it. Time for a PhD. And that's where I ended up. So I personally benefited from it. And I just think it's such a great opportunity for our students to see themselves in a role that maybe they never considered themselves being in.
I would be curious how that is in education, like, you know, how many students really could see themselves in research. It's interesting to see, I'm sure, how that research community is growing with recent things like, you know, the pandemic. And also as, you know, DEI initiatives are becoming more mainstream and, of course, all those wonderful things. I'm sure a lot of research is coming along with that as well. And going off of that thought, Lisa, I'd be interested to hear more about gender equity and also just other minority issues and things of that nature and how they relate to student engagement and research and the benefits of making sure that we include those communities.
Oh, thank you, Lydia. Yeah, I was inspired to hear from all of you, and I was thinking about how, you know, I agree with everything that's been said in terms of benefits already, but my research in particular, I'm an ethnographer by training. So what I do is, you know, the particular populations will emerge as issues emerge, but then I kind of use the same methods, right? So I always use an intersectional lens with any project I do. I always use interviews and observation. And, you know, in that kind of research, themes emerge, right, as salient. So the second book project, which is Success at a Price, Women of Color Students at a White University, actually came out of other data that came from the university in terms of which students need more support against which students who might be doing fine. And so in 2010, there was an equity report that was put out that, you know, made really, like, looked at representation, looked at recruitment, retention, graduation rates of students of color, and overwhelmingly found that women of color students were doing great, like succeeding, off the charts graduation. But then, of course, anecdotally, I'm hearing differently. So we did a program to help support, build community for women of color students. And then from that came the research project. And so it was a team. So it was me, you know, white woman professor with a team of self-defined women of color students. And so from the outset, we, you know, I trained them. It was a small team. So, like, you know, I look at Stevie, like, I think I know your lab is really big. That's part of how I've heard about you. My lab, my team is really small. And so I was able to train them on methods. And, you know, we looked at the questions together. And in women's and gender studies, it's really important to consider the voices of participants, research participants. We kind of redefine what it means to be a research participant in that way. And it was, you know, one of the themes that came out of the study was this lack of belonging, right, at a predominantly white university, in spite of all of our efforts as a university. And so in the book, we talk about this as a well-intentioned university, because that's often what happens with PWIs, is that those universities are well-intentioned and try really hard for inclusion, but sometimes miss the mark. So it's really important to talk to folks who are closest to the experience. And that's in, you know, that's kind of what we do in women's and gender studies, is we go to sort of like ground level in whatever issue you're talking about. So for my students, I mean, gosh, I always say, like, yes, they benefited, right? I mean, writing the letters, they all went to graduate school, they have successful careers of their own. It's been an honor to co-write this book with two of them. We're equal authors on the book manuscript, and the book would not have been the same without them. I needed them. I felt kind of like, do y'all have time for this? You know? Totally. Thank God they did. And, you know, but so for me, there's always a benefit to the research and to me, frankly. But yeah, sure. I mean, I think it did help them build community with our department's a little smaller, so it helps them build community there. Two of the research assistants are still very close friends, you know, 10 years later. So I think that issue of belonging research can help that, right? And as you both were talking, you know, I'm thinking about how we also, for students, redefine what research is, right? It's not the lab coat. You know, it really is community. It is building dialogue. It's sharing knowledge and valuing the knowledge that comes from our students. And if that isn't going to make somebody feel belonging in an institution, what will, right? So absolutely. I think that's I hear it in you, Dave. I'm sure, Stevie, you do the same thing, right? Because you're super approachable and people are maybe nervous before they actually meet you. Mm-hmm. And I find that too, where my students are like, oh, wait, research is this? I get to actually like talk to people and observe. And of course, you know, empirically, like they learn how that then becomes like valid and rigorous. But, you know, just like that it's not just the typical lab coat, you know, with like rats in a cage. Nothing again. I know some of our colleagues do that work and it's amazing. But you know what I mean? It really opens up all, you know, their minds as far as like what research is. And I know that's what happened for me. And for me, it was as a graduate student. Like I, you know, I never would have thought of myself as a researcher. You know, I also had passion for counseling and for social justice. You had passion for teaching. You had, you know, the passion for community interventions. Like, that's what brings us here. But then to talk about, like, how we actually make change, this is one of the ways, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I think just changing their mindset helps. And then also in my projects, there's always a big data set. And they, you know, the second project in particular, they were able to pull from that data set and write their own papers and present their own papers at conferences. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that help them secure the positions in graduate school afterwards. And so I think that, but mostly it's, you know, it's fun, right? Like, it's community
fun.
Yes. Building.
It is fun.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Already in the space, there's a lot of like intersectional things happening, interdisciplinary themes. So yeah, that's interesting.
I appreciate you saying that. If I just might add, you know, a lot of people, when they hear intersectionality, especially my students and just anyone really, it sounds like it's only about our own identities. And so part of what right. we do here is we talk about how it is a theory. It's a theoretical framework and a method, right? A research method. It's a lens. And, you know, not all identities count in every moment. It's whatever data proves salient, right? Whatever findings prove salient. And how important it is to, if you're doing interventions along race, gender, and sexuality, to actually talk to those folks first. It's not the only source of knowledge.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's like how it feels so obvious, right?
Right.
Like, of course you need to talk to the people this impacts
right.
the most, and it doesn't always happen.
Right. And so I think that's in part why, even though, you know, this university isn't necessarily named in the book manuscript, everybody knows that we're at Westchester. I think that's part of the reason why I've been supported to do this research, is because we're all in it for the same reason. And I think our administration knows that, you know, we need different ideas to make change. And that's what these folks tell us. Like, there's a whole chapter on recommendations that come from the participants themselves, you know, and I'm sure you both do the similar kinds of things. And so another thing that I wanted to add is that a lot of people all over the university are doing really good work around race, gender, and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we do it in women's and gender studies, but we're not the only ones, which is what motivated me to do this women's and gender studies collection, because it's not just women's and gender studies. Like, I want people submitting work across campus, you know, like you're talking about your work with the children's literature.
Yeah.
Like, I want our collection to reach teachers.
Ooh,
we'll have to chat.
Yeah, we'll chat.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, it's and that's part of the beauty, I think, of having conversations like this, is how important it is to do it on an interdisciplinary level, you know?
Yeah. I love what you said about the question was, how does being involved with research benefit students? And you emphasize the reciprocity. I'll echo that if it's not totally clear already, like, part of my favorite part of the job is getting to work with students. And so it's personally meaningful to me to be able to interact with them outside the classroom in a smaller context, being able to ask the questions that we're most interested in the research setting. But besides the personal benefits, my research would not be possible without the students. Like, I just, one person cannot do the size of the work that we're doing. And so
now with a 4-4 load.
That's right. Right. So I need the students to be able to do the research. Mm-hmm. And aside from needing them, they really do enhance my work. They make me think differently about things. And I can only see things from, I can try to see things from other perspectives, but I only live in my own perspective. And bringing a more diverse student body to our team, I think that really helps, benefits the questions that we ask, it benefits the interpretation of the data that comes in, makes for better science. And so there are benefits not only to students, but to professors, to the work in general.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you were saying, Stevie, because it makes me think about how this dialogue also happens across our different campus constituents, right? So, you know, I've had an opportunity to work pretty closely with the Center for Women and Gender Equity, you know, in some of my classes, but also they're an equal partner in this Women's and Gender Studies collection. We often share the same students, but not always. So then there's like access to different kinds of students, right? And, you know, I think about the Teaching Learning Center and the development of this open educational resource, which I had no idea. I said I wanted to do, but I didn't know how to do it. You know, they've been so helpful, right, in helping us build that project and build that buzz. And so I think that's part of it, too, is to really make clear that research isn't just in the ivory tower. It's not just in a little room where we're wearing lab coats. Although some, I agree with you, Dave, we should all get the lab coats, right? But it's, you know, it really is. I mean, I'm interested in learning more about your research, Stevie, because to me, it is very community-based in general, you know, and so even if it's not specifically studying communities, right?
Yeah, totally. I can really relate to the importance of moving away from the academic silos. So, like, it's not a bunch of different ivory towers, but also away from the silo of academia and reaching out into the community. So that's kind of one of the main purposes of my work, to be able to say, we have all of these research-supported interventions, but they're not being implemented in the community. But why is that? Is it just the community practitioners are like, forget that. We don't want science-supported interventions. No, of course not. There are real barriers to being able to implement. And so if we listen to the community and kind of partner together on different research projects, we can make everything better, improve the research, improve the implementation, actually make interventions that people are going to use and benefit from.
After taking a look at the benefits of student engagement and research, we're going to examine the challenges and barriers of student engagement and research and creative activity. Dave, you can start us off with that if you're comfortable.
Yeah, sure. Just from what Lisa and Stevie were saying, I was thinking about just the idea of reframing what it means to be a researcher and how I don't know if you all felt it. I certainly still feel imposter syndrome every single day that I'm like, is this book really going to come out? Like, is everyone going to find out that I'm just like this regular person? And so I feel like that's, I still feel it. And I sometimes forget that our students who are working with, many of whom it sounds like a lot of us are working with students who are underrepresented in research fields, right? We actively seek out students who are not in the population of people that we think of as teachers, which is 80% white women. We're looking for students who want to do this work because it affects them personally too. And so something to consider is how it's an additional barrier when you think about what redefining a researcher is for someone who maybe really has never thought of themselves in that role, and redefining what expertise means and what it means to be an expert. Because what good is the ivory tower if it's not accessible to people, right? And if we can't get in there. So that's been a barrier, but something that I'm happy that I'm learning from students that we can work through, and they start to see themselves as experts. Just on a very practical level, we feel in our research group that it's really important to pay students for their work, particularly when we're working with students who are maybe putting themselves through college, have to have other jobs outside of school. And, you know, many students in early grades prep, many of them are double majors, they're having to take at least 18 credits a semester. So finding time for this on top of it, on top of work, on top of having a life outside, which we often forget about. The payment piece feels really important, but it's been a really interesting barrier, this process of getting students hired. And I've been working with human resources and student employment, and they've been like super, super helpful, but there's all these little tiny micro steps. Like, so for example, like our students get field clearances to go out and do their field placements, but those field clearances don't count for the field clearances that they need to be employed. It has something to do with like the Bureau of Labor versus the Bureau of something else that I'm forgetting the name of right now. So they don't have to pay for them. They get a voucher to go do it, but it's one more thing that they have to then go do. And all of our meetings are on Zoom. We find a time that works for everybody, so no one has to physically come anywhere, but they have to go in and they have to sign their I-9s in person. So like all these little things, like we really just wanted to just give each student the $1,000 that we wanted to give to them for the semester, but then there's tax implications for that too that could end up harming them. So we're getting there with figuring it out. And I don't know if you all know this, and if you pay students on grant funds, but if they qualify for federal work study, it's still within the same cost center, but it doesn't deduct from your actual, did you know this? So apparently it's just me that didn't know this. So I'm like, we had all this extra money left over in our PRG grant, and it was going to expire with $4,000 still in there. And so we were able to get an extension, but just a big learning curve in the process of getting students the money that we want to give them for participation. And I know more now, and I'll be able to help more students now, but it's definitely been an interesting learning for me.
It's absolutely a barrier because, you know, a student could have that level of engagement where they're, you know, wanting to be engaging with research, absolutely, but there's that barrier of they just cannot because they have to have money. Everyone has to have money. They have to have food. They have to, right, you know, also
time. Or if a
time.
Student's undocumented, like there's all these other issues, yes, that go along with that too. So it's, there's still more that needs to be done to streamline the process to make it simpler.
Absolutely. And I'm sure there's a lot of things specific to each profession too. I know with teaching, student teaching a lot of times is also unpaid, right?
Oh yeah.
Every time?
They've just passed. Did you all hear this? There's this new initiative where students applied last spring across the Commonwealth to get this paid student teaching experience. And okay, I can't remember what the amount of money is. Not everybody gets it. But many of our students have, so it is cool. It would have been unheard of when I was student teaching and working four jobs, but I'm just so glad that it's one more thing that can reduce the barriers to becoming a teacher that our students are experiencing, but it's not everyone gets that yet. So
yeah,
still
yeah,
more to do.
Absolutely.
With all of the talk about the benefits that being engaged in research has for students, it really ought to be part of the curriculum, not like an addition,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So they should get the course credit for doing it.
Totally.
So it frees up the time in their schedule. They're getting the credit for the work that they're doing. I wish more departments, more programs were able to do that.
Is that something you've been able to work into yours?
Psychology does have a structure by which students can elect to do a field experience or a research experience.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I think our program is so strictly regimented because of how the competencies that they need to pass, but it would be awesome to do that because teachers are researchers, right? Like
right,
you're going in, you're paying attention to what your students are doing and you're learning from it and adapting. So having the opportunity for everyone to do that would be so important.
Yeah. And if, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay.
I was saying if the department doesn't have the resources for it, to have some way have the colleges or the university at large make that a part of something. You know how we're all responsible, yeah, in our departments to do a capstone, mm-hmm, which we all do, right? But if there would be some kind, and not to add extra coursework to the student, but to do something, what you're saying, because I know about psychology's program, and I know a lot of your faculty, we share a lot of the same students. You're also a really big department. You have a lot of faculty. You also have like 900 majors, yes, right? So we do not have that. We don't have that many faculty. It probably wouldn't work to make that such a regular part of our curriculum, but I would like to be able to do that. So is there a way that maybe some departments could work together, some of the smaller departments in a particular college could work together to model ourselves after what you're doing in psychology, because you can, because you're big and, you know, have more resources, but we could craft that too differently. I was thinking when you said that, I thought that that would be a really good idea. In addition to paying, I also would never, I always pay my students. And that means sometimes that I don't do as much research that I would like to do, or I'm not able to do as much. But for me, it's been funding them through internal, external grants. It's been less projects. You know, I write books. I don't write papers. So it's not as much of, it's not as much production, but it's like a lot of focus on process for a small group of students. So I think that's a good thing too. We haven't faced the same kind of logistics that you've faced, Dave, but I think it might just be because I also was doing this a few years ago, right? Like I'm just now finishing, like the book is going to be out in spring, right? So it's done, but the research was done a while ago. So I think also we are growing as an institution. As an institution, you know, we just became R2, right? Like we're bringing in, I mean, you're an assistant professor, almost getting ready to get tenure and promotion, you're associate, like we're bringing in people who do research with their students. So let's find a way to support that in academic affairs that would then, of course, be in collaboration with OSRP. But I feel like that the funding piece is the most important piece for my students. They couldn't do it without financial, and I wouldn't want them to do it. You know, yeah, one of our findings, of course, is how students are given opportunities on this campus, especially students of color, to speak on behalf of their communities, which then, of course, offers them, you know, like a mic and a spotlight and professional opportunities that they might not have had otherwise. But if they're not paid for that, that can also feel like emotional labor, which is one of my areas of research, you know. And so it's, we have to be kind of careful that we don't, and we don't, you know, and I think many of us would never want to or never exploit our students, but I think we have to be careful about that as an institution, because it's really easy to say the benefits, but we need to also talk about money and time. Time's the other big one, which again, you know, Stevie's such a good solution, right? Like if it's a part of the coursework already, that helps with time. You know, if we can craft like some of the funding so we're not always so, or like partition it out so we're not always so dependent on internal and external grants, that would be part of the money, right? But that's, I noticed in our notes preparing for this podcast that we all said time and money, right? Like that's our short answer, right? Time and money are the biggest barriers. And I think that, I don't know, I've been here a long time and I've seen us grow as a university, and it's so exciting to meet colleagues who are also doing research with students. I mean, I would say more of us are doing that than less.
Dave, you brought up work study. The last figure that I heard, this might be outdated, maybe a couple years, but was that we sent back like $100,000 of unused work study dollars to the federal government.
Don't do it.
Right. So if that's a problem, right?
Yeah.
So
like, and an opportunity.
And an opportunity. Work study benefits the students who qualify, but students are saying, you know, there aren't positions that are desirable for me, or I can't take it on with all of my other commitments. But if we could create research opportunities that we could fund with work study, it's helpful in giving that time that we're looking for. It's helpful in that we don't have to actually get additional grants to pay for students, and it's helpful in funding students to do these research opportunities.
Such a great point.
It is such a good point. Yeah, it makes me think too that, again, back to the re-explaining what research actually is points that we were making earlier, you know, I think flexibility would be another important factor in supporting students who want to do research, making sure that students, more students have access to their faculty. The research itself, you know, whatever tasks they're given, if that could be flexible in time and space, if they could, you know, do some of it where they don't necessarily have to be in a lab, you know, I mean, some kind of offering flexibility, I think, would really help. We have so many more students now than we did just a few short years ago. And I think also a lot of our students are non-traditional. A lot of our students are parents, you know, have families. And so thinking about that flexibility piece and letting them know that we have opportunities for them that also would accommodate their schedules, I think would be really important.
If that's all right.
So I have a plug, you have a plug. Okay, cool.
I've got a plug. Let's plug it up.
All right, here we go. So, okay. Well, I just want to plug that we have something called Research Camp that we are trying for the first time this winter. My close colleague in psychology, Dr. Lauren Brumley, and I are trying to attract sophomore students who have not been involved in research before. We're paying them to engage in research camp with us over winter session, where they're going to gain some basic research skills alongside of a faculty member and a graduate student. So we're hoping to pilot it, see how it goes, and then maybe spread it to campus. This is with some funding from the Office of DEI.
Yay.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
And it's paid. Yeah, so there we go.
What's camp going to be like?
I know. That sounds fun.
Well, so they'll pick a primary research mentor. We have four faculty in psychology. Like I said, we're going to pilot in psychology, then hopefully spread if we have proof of concept. They'll attend seminar where they learn basic skills like literature review, basic data analysis, working with human subjects and animal models, maybe a couple of other topics. And then they'll have individual meetings with their research mentor and a graduate student. We're trying to facilitate that near-peer interaction. And then we'll be assigning like small tasks on projects that we're working on in the labs.
That is awesome.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Looking forward to it. Can you explain a little bit more the near peer initiative?
Sure. Yeah. So some of the work that I do is targeting recruitment of people who have been generally underrepresented in graduate programs. One of the types of events that we do is like a specialized visit day. So people who identify in a certain way are invited to visit our graduate program. And all the while, we collect satisfaction surveys. How much did you like this visit? What was the best part? One of the things that has come out of the satisfaction survey is connecting not just with faculty, but with the graduate students themselves has been some of the most valued and satisfying aspects. So to me, that means it's not enough for just faculty to say, let me engage with the student, but to facilitate someone who might be closer in their developmental level as far as like the research trajectory, the educational trajectory, so that they have a near peer. So if you know, maybe they don't feel comfortable asking a faculty member for how do I reformat this data or something like that, but they would feel more comfortable asking a graduate student. We want to facilitate as many connections as possible. Another just practical thing is the graduate students are closer to the graduate school application than I am, and so they might be able to give some additional insight and help with grad school applications. So your peers could be helpful in the lab and in applying for graduate school, things like that.
That's a wonderful resource. And I know we touched on imposter syndrome, but like you said, you know, the grad student is a little bit closer to their developmental level. So maybe it's kind of being able to see themselves in this grad student thinking, oh, I can pursue grad school. I can pursue my PhD. So that's
right.
Interesting.
So like, for example, as an undergrad, I probably wouldn't have gone to the PI, even though I had the question to ask, like, should I wear a lab coat on the first day of lab? Maybe had I known a graduate student, I'd be like, so are we wearing lab coats? Or
what? Where do I get one of those? I love it.
That's awesome.
That's funny. All right. Go ahead, Lisa.
Sure. So as I mentioned, we received funding last year to develop this Women's and Gender Studies collection, which is an open educational resource website where people can submit and go through peer review. We have two peer review. So it's a scholarly project. I mean, for newer scholars, students, et cetera, it's a very supportive process, you know, because if they get a revise and resubmit, then we offer a consultation to help with that revision. But then also for the rest of us, it's great because if you are somebody who would like to have your work out there and freely accessible, we all know how long traditional publication takes. Yeah. We'll talk, Dave. I hear you. And, you know, also sometimes where we publish isn't the most accessible. So this is a really cool opportunity to build community and dialogue in those ways too. So we've done this, we've built a site, we've had a couple of cool events last year to build buzz around it, but this month, October 24th in Sykes, we're having the live launch. Ooh. Along with a day of celebration of women's and gender studies, race, gender, and sexuality studies. So we're bringing in Ijoma Oluwau. I don't know if you know her work, but she's a public intellectual writer who has published three books on race. One is like on mediocre white men. One is on Let's Talk About Race. You know, and she has her newest out too. She's coming to do the keynote. Wow. We'll also have student research panels. One on sexuality studies, one on transnational feminisms, which are two like subdisciplines in our work, and a lot of food and a lot of fun. And, you know, there's, I'm pretty sure the office has a flyer because we've been circulating it everywhere, but I'm happy to continue to share. Oh, please. And people can register for free. It's open to the public. So we're also connecting with admissions and, you know, sharing with high school students, hoping some folks can come out and hang out with us at Sykes on October 24th.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
We'll have to add a link. Yeah, I'm
like, yeah, we're going to add a link.
We're gonna add a link in the description of this podcast.
Yes,
that is so wonderful. And now I'm like, I should go to that.
You should go to that. Bring your classes. Like, it's going to be fun. Yeah.
That's wonderful. All right, Dave, go ahead. Anything to plug?
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to Darris McInnes and Katie Manwiller, my research collaborators that have made the process of working with students possible. I mean, we talked about this before, like without good collaborators, like there's not much that we would be able to do. And this is our fifth semester doing this with students. So like we were kind of building the plane as we were flying it, but like now like the plane is cruise controlling. So like that feels really good. I just had a little brain moment. I have a book coming out I said at the beginning of the podcast, but it's called Addressing Stress with Self-Compassion, A Guide for Early Childhood Teachers. And it's really just a practical, more palatable version of my dissertation, where there's prompts that early career teachers and pre-service teachers can do to write themselves these self-compassionate letters about challenges that they're experiencing as they learn to become teachers. I don't know how familiar people are with self-compassion. It often gets conflated with self-care, but to make the case for the difference of these two things, self-care versus self-compassion, self-care is always something you have to wait for. It's delayed, right? Like when I was teaching, it would have been frowned upon to like crack a beer in the middle of the day, right? Like with my students right there. But self-compassion is how you relate to these moments of stress and suffering as they arise. So if you imagine something that didn't go well for you professionally this week, and you think about the words and phrases that come to mind about yourself when you think about that, it's usually pretty negative. But if you imagine the exact same thing happened to someone that you love, someone that you care about, and what you would say to them, it's usually very different, right? So self-compassion is about reframing the way that you respond to your mistakes, these challenges, the same way that you would to someone in your life that you love, which you should be someone that in your life that you love, right? So that's really what the book is all about. And then I also have a podcast. It's called I Still Believe in School. So much of the...
I love it.
Oh, thanks.
I love it.
Thanks. I write all the music myself, which is really fun. I'm kind of like pulling together all the nerdy things that I love to do into one space. But my students have been telling me that they're just very overwhelmed by all the negative messaging right now about becoming a teacher. And... I mean, I wrote my book because I know that teaching is stressful, right? But there's also beautiful things that happen every day, exciting things, funny things that happen every day. So every episode of the podcast, I bring on one of my favorite teachers, either one that I had or somebody that I worked with. My middle school and high school Latin teacher are coming on in December, my chorus teacher from high school, my drama teacher from middle school. And then just like best friends from when I was teaching. And they talk about like their funniest teaching stories, what inspired them to become a teacher, the greatest opportunities facing school right now, and then why, despite all the challenges, they still believe in school. And then I use ChatGPT to make a trivia game based on what they taught, and it's a 10-question trivia game, and every question that they get right, I donate $10 to a Donors Choose project that they select. So Donors Choose is the biggest fundraising platform for teachers. They put grants up there for classroom supplies. I personally benefited from it as a teacher. So it's just kind of a fun way to share some positivity, but also like bring some joy to classroom teachers and their students.
That's wonderful. And what a great way to share those resources in a way that you can actually absorb that information. And like you said, you wrote this dissertation, but not everyone can kind of decode that language.
Oh, yeah.
So being able to, you know, create the book, create the podcast is a way of building that community and kind of, you know, talking about your specialties in a way where other people can really engage and understand. And like we're saying, you know, understand that research is a space where all can be welcomed. And it's not so scary, you know.
Yeah.
Especially once you develop those skills too.
Totally.
But yeah.
Totally.
So I also would like to offer a shout out to the folks at the Center for Women and Gender Equity, because they put what we learn and teach in the classroom into action on campus and in communities and beyond. And it really, I think, shows how research is really about community and dialogue. And it's not just about data and documentation, although those two things are very important too. At the end of the day, it's about dialogue.
Thank you for tuning in to the Office of Research and Sponsored Programs Faculty Forum. Thank you, Dr. Stevie Grissetti, Dr. David Berry, and Dr. Lisa Huebner for joining us. We appreciated the discussion.